Blog Talk Radio.
Hello everyone, this is Peter Paul Verzola, working with The New Shadow. Today is September 22nd, it's a very interesting day in American history. Today in San Francisco, well not today, on September 22nd, 1975, there was an attempted assassination of President Gerald Ford as he came out of a hotel. This attempted assassination was important because, or significant because, his life was saved by a disabled U.S. Marine who was, I won't say in the closet, but he didn't politicize his sexual preference, but he was outed by Herb Cain, the late and in some quarters, some thinking quarters, unlamented, a gossip columnist who actually never wrote his column in his latter days. But a woman named Carol Vernier at the San Francisco Chronicle. It was kind of a sycophant, one of those people who hang around wealthy and important people or people that they think are important. And if he didn't like you, he'd trash you, and he'd go into restaurants and tell them, if I don't like the food or if you charge me, I'll trash the restaurant in my column. That's the type of person this Herb Cain was. But we have those types. This is what I call a media moron. But Oliver Sipple deflected Sarah Jane Moore's aim at when she tried to assassinate President Ford. And he was outed, and it destroyed his life. He died in 1989. Sarah Jane Moore was released after 30 years, released from federal prison. And she got out January 1st, 2008. I don't know what she's doing now. Of course, Ford died, I think, in 2003. But this is an important date in San Francisco. Also, in San Francisco, a couple of weeks before that, I think, or that year, there, Charles Manson, who I met, and I didn't know who he was when I was walking dogs, met him in the Haight-Ashbury, and I didn't know he hung out there. But Sarah Jane Moore's attempted assassination of Ford occurred in the same period as the Tate-LaBianca Folger murders, those horrible murders that Charles Manson and his cult participated in. And they're still looking for bodies down there in Southern California. But, that's the way things are. There's some interesting birthdays this month, this day, I should say, great actors. Those of you who remember the paper chase about the law student at, I think it was Bridges, who played the role of a first-year law student at Harvard Law Law School, and John Houseman played Professor Kingsbury, who had a very engaging daughter. I think it was Candace Bergen, if I'm not mistaken. And if you remember, that film was made Houseman more famous than he already was. He was a director. Interesting man, Houseman. He anglicized his name from Houssman. His father was Alsatian. His mother was British. He was born in Romania and emigrated to the United States and worked with Orson Welles. So those of you who remember the War of the Worlds, the film that some people still consider, the radio program, excuse me, it's a classic, and that frightened the entire nation. People, when it was broadcast, people thought that the United States was actually being invaded by aliens, and Orson Welles utilized that. Of course, he never lived that down. Houseman worked with Welles on another picture, Citizen Kane, which is the not so fictionalized or not so subtle biography of the late William Randolph Hearst, the founder of the Hearst newspaper media chain. William Randolph Hearst, I think I mentioned this before, after World War II, the veterans who came back were clamoring for veterans' benefits. They didn't want to be ripped off like the World War I veterans were, and who had to march on Washington during the Hoover administration, and General Douglas MacArthur, who was chief of staff of the U.S. Army, was ordered by Hoover to disperse the bonus marchers, as they were called. Well, the World War II veterans who came back from that horrible war didn't want to go through that experience as their fathers and grandfathers had, and there was a debate in Congress as to whether or not to provide a veterans bill and veterans benefits for these guys to go back to school. Some had interrupted their college education. Others couldn't even start, and others wanted to go into trade school. And it was Hearst who ordered his newspapers to editorialize and support benefits for American war veterans. So that's one of the good things he did. He did some bad things, like him and Pulitzer during the Spanish-American War actually started that war by inflammatory newspaper stories about alleged Spanish atrocities in Cuba. Typically, a lot of these stories that start fictionalized news, or fiction that passes as news, we find out later that it didn't happen. Also, the Hearst papers in their latter days, such as in Chicago, the old Chicago American, on a slow news day, what the editors would do was fictionalize a murder in the south side of Chicago, among which was predominantly black. in most of the areas, and that's how they tried to bump up circulation, but it didn't work, and they died a well-deserved death. This is also other films by John Houseman and some other interesting biographical aspects of this famous director, actor. He helped founded the Juilliard School of Drama. He worked on many plays, even some operas, and among the films he did were Julius Caesar, Citizen Kane. He worked on that, and he had a falling out with Orson Welles on that film about Hearst. And because he, it's interesting, history has come full circle. We are seeing the Obama administration attempting to fund theater groups and artistic groups, and I guess they're trying to take a leaf from Franklin Delano Roosevelt's biography and his administration when they had WPA projects, Works Projects Administration. The administration funded artists, and in fact, in some of the post offices, you go in and you look at the ceiling or you look at the walls, they still preserved the murals that were done by unemployed artists that Franklin Delano Roosevelt's administration employed in these arts projects. They did some great work. And, I mean, it's real art. It's not the schlock that passes as art, as you might see in some of these museums. He also did, because he was an alien, he didn't become a United States citizen until during World War II. He worked for the Office of War Information, which was quite a job in those days. And, you know, it's propaganda. And he worked with Marlon Brando in the film. He worked on that. He produced about 18 films for Paramount. Julius Caesar, which is the great classic with James Mason, Louis Calhoun, who played Julius Caesar, Edmund O'Brien, who couldn't get rid of his New York accent or Boston accent, who played, I think it was Casca, and they had John Gielgud. It's the classic of all the Julius Caesar films, and that one was done in black and white. And then those of you who remember Smith Barney, he made a lot of money doing the ads for them, and remember how he ended the ad? They earned it, and indeed they did, but they must have squandered it because they're out of business. So it's also the birthday of Paul Muni. Paul Muni, another great Jewish actor, the don't know if he practiced, but he is the uncle, the late uncle of Michael Thomas or Tomaszewski, who is the conductor and principal conductor of the San Francisco Symphony. And Michael is a gay activist, unfortunately. And, you know, he's a good musician. His musical compositions are, you know, are eminently forgettable. But Muni made a lot of the social relevant films in during the 30s. And he worked with Bessie Thomas was, I think, his sister-in-law. And he worked with the Yiddish Theater of New York. But the social relevant films that he did, which one of the great prison films, I'm an escapee from a chain gang, which was about, he played World War I veteran who returned, couldn't find a job, and he was on the boxcars. And when you were considered a vagrant in a lot of rural counties, especially in the South, if you were a young man or just a person riding the rails, as it were, and he was arrested and accused of, he witnessed the robbery and he took the fall, even though he was not involved. He ended up on a horrible chain gang in, I believe it was Georgia, where there was incredible brutality. He escaped twice. And it's a great, great film. Yeah, I recommend it. And it also, that film led to the reform efforts of prison reformers to get rid of the chain gangs, and particularly poor whites, you know, although you generally think we've got the impression that it's only blacks that were sentenced to the chain gangs. And these sentences were long, the conditions were brutal, and people often died, young men often died under mysterious circumstances. Another great film out of, which is related, was called Brubaker, which was about the notorious Tucker Farm prison in Arkansas. Incidentally, anybody who wants to call in, I'd like to hear from you. The call-in number is 1-347-633-9620. That's 1-347-633-9620. And they used the film, the name Brubaker. It was about, I think the guy was Merton. He was a California penologist, and he was brought in by Governor Rockefeller, the brother of Nelson Rockefeller, and to clean up the horrible Arkansas prison system. And he found too many dead bodies and too many politicians, and they forced him out. And Robert Redford played Brubaker. Incidentally, getting back to, and since we're on the topic of the Rockefellers, not Winthrop, one of the I think it was Winthrop who was governor of Arkansas. There's so many of these Rockefellers. And currently, Jay Rockefeller was his nephew, who was the senator from West Virginia, who married a senator's daughter, Percy, who was also the head of NPR and public broadcasting. But Gerald Ford, after Richard Nixon was forced to resign after the Watergate scandal, this is interesting because this may come into play now, and that's why this is relevant. If Obama is forced to resign or resigns, we have the Secretary of State who's in line with Hillary, who's always wanted and always thought that she should sit on her, as George Bush said, on her fat ass in the Oval Office. There's a book out by the speechwriter of George Bush. He was interviewed today. It's called Speeches, something like that. His name is Latimer, and he was talking about George Bush and the second, and what George Bush thought of the candidates. He didn't like Palin. She wasn't prepared for national office, and Obama didn't have a clue, and Hillary wanted to sit on her fat butt, and he used the other word, the A word, in the Oval Office. But what's interesting is if Obama, if he resigns, which a growing number of people wish he would, we'll see the succession, and Biden supposedly has a heart problem. So that'll mean that Pelosi will be positioned, Hillary will be positioned, the Secretary of Defense will be positioned to move into the Oval Office, and a growing number of people would like to see Nancy D'Alessandro Pelosi. She was the daughter of the mayor of Baltimore. They would like to see her resign. She's not going to do that, probably not, but she can be forced to retire. And she's made a lot of money with her winery and real estate investments. It's, I don't know how she made it, and people are still asking the question but don't get an answer. But if Gerald Ford, who succeeded Agnew, who was also from Baltimore, when Nixon resigned, Agnew had to Agnew, who was the county executive of Baltimore, was caught up in scandals, and he was forced to resign. And so Gerald Ford, the Republican speaker, I think was leader in the House, he was selected to become vice president. When Nixon was forced out, Gerald Ford got Nelson Rockefeller, the governor of New York. Now, Nelson was very famous. He had the Rockefeller interests were involved in the oil interests in Venezuela, which has become a major problem for the United States and South America. And Nelson worked in World War II. He was bilingual, spoke Spanish, and he worked for the federal government in one of the positions in World War II. But Rockefeller, when he was governor of New York, and this is about the same time we had the, I think it was 1970-71, when they had the Attica prison riots in upstate New York at Attica Prison, which it was that prison and all the problems of that prison were broadcast around the world. What had happened was Rockefeller ordered an assault on the prison. A lot of people were killed. The New York State Police brutalized inmates, whether they were guilty or not. They stripped them naked and had them out in the yard. The prison yard, and films were taken. They were beaten as they came back into the prison. They were not given clothes, and they were thrown naked, packed into cells. Of course, there was destruction of some of the cell blocks. And Rockefeller refused to come to the prison to at least talk to the prisoner leaders and see what was wrong. And he refused to do that, and that's a stain on his reputation. Of course, he died in the arms of a secretary. He was divorced from a woman called Happy Rockefeller, his Mary Todd Hunter Clark, a nice woman, and, of course, the way he treated her. But, you know, these guys get their karma, whether they're politicians or the average Joe citizen. But Rockefeller's, that's a big stain on his biography, and, of course, you know, wherever he's at, he may meet some of those prisoners, wherever he's at, heaven, which a lot of people don't think he's at, or in hell, where a lot of people wishes he was sent. But that's what happened. And, of course, we have the problem in California with Governor Schwarzenegger, who inherited a prison system that's a mess. And it's overcrowded. And, of course, one of the projects we are working on, Jack Cashel and retired Navy JAGs, other people, the famous Dreisbach family, formerly of Pennsylvania, have worked on for the last 13 years, the Stephen Neary case, who should be freed from the state prison system. Incidentally, the Marine that I talked about who was illegally he had a kangaroo court trial down in Southern California. He was in prison in California prison system for 10 years. He was just exonerated, and now the Marines and the Navy Department, since the Marines are part of the Department of the U.S. Navy, owe him. He's trying to get over $250,000 that's owed him in allowances and back pay. And, of course, in California, the rule is, the law is, that prisoners who are illegally in prison and who are exonerated are entitled to $100 a day. It's the highest payment in the country. I think in Texas it's $10,000. I don't know what it is in Illinois, but there are a couple other military personnel who are illegally, I'm hearing about this, in prison in California state prison system, and maybe also around the country. We've had the case of Timothy Matthews in Colorado, who was accused as a 15-year-old boy, accused of murdering this woman who was twice his size, murdering and raping her, I believe. And he joined the Navy at 18, like Steve Neary did, and then the Fort Collins police went after him, and the DA, a corrupt DA, later became a judge and now has been censored by the authorities in Colorado. They railroaded Timothy Matthews into state prison, in Colorado State Prison, and he fought back, and he was recently exonerated. In fact, it was seen on 48 Hours. They featured his story. Steve Nerish has not gotten that publicity yet, but he will get it, we believe. Incidentally, upcoming on 48 Hours is a case here in San Francisco that has reached, has been broadcast around the world. The French government was involved. They sent in a French magistrate to investigate the case, which is very, which is highly unusual. The Hugues de la Plaza case, his father was in the French Navy. That may have helped to get the investigation going. That his story, how he was supposedly committed suicide with a knife, which they never found, and blood all over the place, and committed suicide 2 years ago. They're not calling suicide, it's indeterminate death, but the father and the parents and the French media think it's murder, and a lot of his neighbors think if it is in the serious circumstances, the death is a murder. He didn't commit suicide. That's the feeling of his neighbors. But that will be broadcast on 48 Hours. But Paul Muni also did a film on military injustice. It was a first of nine films, it's, the most films on this case, the Captain Alfred Dreyfus case. 100 years ago, from this captain was from a wealthy Jewish family from Alsace-Lorraine, which had the Germans had won in the Franco-Prussian War. It's a piece of land on the border there between France and Germany, which goes back and forth. Currently, it's French, and we joke the next war it'll be German, if Germany and France goes at it again. But anyway, he was a French, went into the French army, studied at Saint-Cyr, which is the French West Point, and he went. He was aloof. He was married. And he didn't socialize with his fellow officers who, since it was peacetime, you do what officers do, party, gamble, chase women. And he was set up by a guy named Esterhazy, who was Hungarian and somehow got into the French army. And Esterhazy needed money. He was running a male whorehouse in Paris. He was involved with the famous French, British writer who was involved in... what was he wrote? A Ballad of Reading Jail. Anyway, he set up Esterhazy set up Dreyfus. And Esterhazy was selling the secrets of the latest French cannon. The French are famous for their small cannon. In fact, Napoleon was an expert in artillery. Even the great Duke of Wellington admired the French artillery skill. And especially at the Battle of Waterloo, but of course Napoleon lost that one. But anyway, Dreyfus was set up, and because he was Jewish, he was targeted, and he had a kangaroo court military trial, and was closed, and he was railroaded. They wanted him to commit suicide. He wouldn't do it, and he ended up on Devil's Island in the Guyana, which interestingly, where Reverend Jim Jones. Fled after, also in the 1970s, after the horrible things he did here in San Francisco. And the anniversary is coming up in a few weeks in October. The city has never gotten over the month of October when Jim Jones went down to Guyana, had people commit mass suicide with Kool-Aid. Kool-Aid's had a bad name ever since then. And, of course, the assassination by Dan White of Harvey Milk and Mayor Moscone. And there's more that's going to come out on that. But anyway, Dreyfus fought back. It took him nearly 10 years to prove his innocence, that he wasn't, and he didn't need to sell military secrets to the Germans. And Esterhazy eventually fled to England and wrote a book. And the movie was... how can I forget it? Anyway, that's one of the movies that Paul Muni starred in, and I would highly recommend that. And there's also Dreyfus's great nephew is the actor Richard Dreyfus, who starred in the latest film about Captain Dreyfus's trial and exoneration. So... Jacques, that's the name of the film. And Paul Muni and the Warner Brothers got an Academy Award for that film. Some of it was fictionalized, but It was still a great film, and there had been eight others, a couple of them in foreign languages, French. Today is also the birthday of the great Austrian director and writer, Erich von Stroheim, who wrote, he worked with Garbo, and he did quite a few films in his long career, and he was born in 1885, and he ranks among the great foreign directors who came to Hollywood, and you can see some of his films. He made a couple of anti-war films relating to World War I with Jean Gabin, a great war film. Check it out. And interestingly, this general, this Confederate general, you don't hear too much about him, is called Eppa Hutton, and he was involved in Pickett's Charge. This was General Pickett. And this was the big mistake that Lee made at Gettysburg. If you know the story, and I recommend the film that HBO was put out on Gettysburg, where Martin Sheen played General Lee. And, of course, the whole thing, like a lot of these battles, these famous battles, occur by accident. Gettysburg was an accident, which, fortunately, the Union won. But Eppa Hutton had the same problem that Napoleon had. Napoleon always started his battles at the crack of dawn, but even in the film Napoleon, which was a Russian, Sergei Bondarchuk, great Russian director, made that film with Rod Steiger and Christopher Plummer played Duke of Wellington. Great film, great battles. But apparently Napoleon had an anal fistula or hemorrhoids, and his thinking was off. He was in a lot of pain, and he started the battle late. And had he started it earlier, he would have probably crushed Wellington. And Wellington was saved by the arrival of the Prussian army under General Blücher, who hated the French. But Eppa Hutton also had that problem, and he served throughout he was a Confederate general who served throughout the Civil War. It's interesting, these afflictions that people come down with, but yet they still serve. If you're looking at, you're hearing things about ACORN, what I call the bad seed, there's a lot there that has not been publicized. And there is this big, Glenn Beck, now he's being criticized and castigated, I think, to throw people off that he's really saying some things that are substantive and have been and can be documented. But the San Francisco connection is a lot worse than people think. In fact, most people are not aware that ACORN's origins go back to the 1920s and 30s, the Depression, when Al Capone, believe it or not, he probably shook down merchants, started a soup kitchen for the hungry unemployed in Chicago. And given how the mafia worked, they extorted things, and they may still be doing this, the mafia that's still around, or the other mafias, the Russian, the Chinese, because there are other mafias in America. But anyway, even the Hearst History Channel ran something on that. But the founder, one of the political godfathers or founders of ACORN, Saul Alinsky, was working with Al Capone. And reportedly, I had to do a paper, and I had to meet him for my social science class and speech class, and I had met him. He had a thing called the Woodlawn Organization in the south side of Chicago, and I had to go down and interview him, and it was a brief interview. But he came to San Francisco in the late 60s or mid-60s, set up shop in San Francisco, and we have a lot of organizations that are like Tides, Bridge Housing, a center for third world organizing, the San Francisco Organizing Project, the Midwest Academy, which was, and this is where we get all these community organizers, was set up in Chicago and was run by Paul and Heather Booth, who have decamped and gone to Washington. And they succeeded in hijacking a lot of the federal poverty programs. That's where a lot of the money's gone and is going, and they have not accounted for and can't account for the money, just like ACORN can't afford to the millions of dollars that they got, and they're in the affordable housing real estate racketeering in New York and they're under all these other, they operate under all these other names or operate with people under organizations under all these other names. They're like an octopus which has tentacles all over the place. So you're going to hear more about that, and we will be bringing up Brigadier Ingalls. I had to find the photos, and we have those and putting that together. And with November coming up, we'll have some specials on, interestingly, a lot of foreign military people retire in California, especially the British. So I wrote an article called The Sun Never Sets on the British Army Veterans. They all camp in California. We've had quite a few. The last survivor of Gallipoli, the last British American, Colonel Hodges served at Gallipoli. He caught the fever, and he was evacuated on the sister ship of the Titanic, the Britannica, and that ship, I think, was torpedoed. The Titanic was hit by an iceberg. But anyway, the same shipyard in Ireland had built those big liners. But during World War II, after the war, there was a depression in England, and a lot of British, young British men emigrated to the States. And in 1940, in an interview I did with him, went down to San Jose after I returned from a stint in Australia, New Zealand. He said that in 1940, they knew FDR knew that there was going to the United States would be drawn into the war. He didn't mention Pearl Harbor, so the word went out to the British officers who retired or had served in World War One to join the World War Department, and it's now the Defense Department, and to prepare get ready to train the expected numbers of men coming into the Army and the Air Force, and or the Army Air Corps, but into the U.S. Army. There were about 10,000 of these ex-British soldiers and officers living in the States, and Hodges became a colonel in charge of a WAC unit up here in the San Francisco area, and some funny stories about him commanding a battalion of WACs. These are Women's Army Corps. And there were other British officers. There's also Canadian officers living in this area, Polish officers, survivors of Bataan Corregidor. I haven't run into any French Legionnaire officers. That's the one I haven't. And, of course, I knew all my Nazi officers and a few SS people from back east. In fact, one of the I met and stayed as a guest in my house, the nephew of General Guderian, the famous tank general of World War II. And, unfortunately, he only stayed one night, and I wanted to get to know more about his family. Ironically, he was from New Jersey, where there seemed to be a lot of Germans, and there were some Nazis there before World War II. But there are a lot of these people, and we will be broadcasting excerpts from the several interviews that I did. One of the interesting things that I did learn was that one guy was British. He in the SOE, Special Operations Executive, which was like their kind of a cross between commandos and CIA and Rangers and that sort. And he was one of the British officers who helped prevent Greece from being taken over by the communists after World War II. But he mentioned that I didn't know this, and a lot of people didn't know this, that Ireland, well, we knew that Ireland, the Republic, had stayed out of the war. They were neutral. And, of course, the Nazis had a lot of sympathy there because the Irish had never forgiven the British and the Black and Tans, that division of the British Army, which had terrorized Ireland, and especially in the East Rebellion, when a lot of Irish leaders were executed. And, of course, I would recommend the film Michael Collins. It's a very accurate film on one of the great leaders of Ireland who fought for to free Ireland, Republic of Ireland, from the British. Or it wasn't Republic of Ireland, but it was all Ireland. And he was assassinated by one of his own people, apparently. But anyway, there were about 10,000, from what this officer told me, 10,000 Irish who came over to Britain to join the British forces to fight against Hitler. And, of course, you see this in the film A Bridge Too Far, which was about the badly planned Market Garden, which was campaign, which was to short circuit the German army and go around it and capture all the bridges over the Rhine. And this was General Montgomery, or Field Marshal Montgomery's plan. And the whole thing was bungled. Whether the radios didn't work, they went a bridge too short. In fact, Robert Redford played in that movie, and he's the one who kept saying, "We need a Hail Mary," or "Hail Mary" as they're crossing the river. But I would recommend that film. And they had the Irish Guards, which was a tank battalion that was up going up this one road to try to get to Arnhem, and they had to fight their way up. And the Germans were shooting at them with artillery and anti-tank guns all along the way. And it was a great film. So it's the parts of history we don't hear about. Oh, the one thing about Haussmann I forgot is that during the Depression, they also had the Negro Theater. That's what they called blacks, but people don't know, in those days, and even until recently. And that was quite groundbreaking, because whites generally did not work with blacks. And although the great film and play that came out of that era, Cyril Connolly did a film with blacks, and I think Eartha Kitt, the other black woman, was a singer in it, and I forgot so many films. Anyway, the name Cyril Connolly, he was the director of this black film, and I forgot her name. She married Lenny Hayden, great singer. Anyway, there were men of goodwill who broke the color line and worked across the races, if I can put it that way, to try to help these people. And the Negro Theater was one of the things that came out of the Depression, and John Haussmann worked with them also, and he's a man without bias. So we honor him, his memory today. He was born, and of course he died in Malibu. He lived to be about 96. But these are some of the interesting birthdays today. Oh, and also I forgot one of the few women that survived Henry VIII, Anna of Cleves. She was born in 1515, and she was the one, they got a divorce. She didn't lose her head in more ways than one. So, and then, of course, there was the last woman who survived him. I forgot her name. I think Anna was the last one. She was Cleves, which was what is Belgium today. I think it's Belgium or the Lowlands, as it was called then. But she survived Henry VIII. And she was born today. And another classic film is with Charles Laughton and the Wives of Henry VIII, and that great film, the great English actor, got him an Academy Award. And it was another film that came out of the 30s, and she is depicted in that film also. But there's our film biography for today. We're going to be... I will be getting into more things and running more interviews from people, and we're trying to set up some more stuff to make this it's supposed to be an eclectic program. I would also recommend that you go to our videos sites, YouTube, Amicus Veritas, AmicusVeritas, and also our websites. We've spent 10 years on a lot of these things, at Amicusveritas, our blog. We'll be updating the Californians Against Voter Fraud. Oh, I got a cat on my shoulder here. Cat on a hot tin shoulder. The military law and history, that one. And then we'll be exposing more corrupt judges and lawyers. Incidentally, typically of the legal profession, and I use that word carefully, because there's so many of these people, a growing number of these lawyers and judges who are a little more than whores with a bar card. Remember Zoe Baird? She was Bill Clinton's first nominee to be attorney general. Well, she almost made it until they discovered that she had hired an illegal alien as a maid, and so she had to withdraw. Well, now, and here's a woman, a lawyer, and she was going to be attorney general to make to help make the laws, make and enforce the laws. Well, we now, the Labour Party in Britain has got a big scandal. Their Attorney General, a woman, she's a baroness, and she wrote the law on British citizens hiring illegals. And turns out she had this woman for a couple of years from Tonga who had been illegally in Britain. She had overstayed her visa. She had been in Britain for, I think she was working for the baroness for about 2 years. She got caught keeping this woman employed in her house, and they think she did know that she was illegally in Britain. And so here's another case of these people make the laws and enforce the laws, but they don't apply to themselves. So that's something that people ought to keep in mind, to rein these people in, because I think the country's focusing on some of these bogus nonprofits like Acorn, and they're looking at some of these bankers and financial institutions like Lehman Brothers and the rest. I think maybe they'll start looking at some of these corrupt lawyers. Of course, you know Van Jones, who was forced out, had a law degree from Yale. Of course, it's not the degree that a person has, it's what they do with it and whether they are competent, ethical, and honest. And increasingly, in my own experience and experience of other people and dealing with other lawyers and discussing this aspect of the profession, we're seeing more and more lawyers who come into court and lie, perjure themselves and present false evidence, even in a couple of cases, in my case, attempted to intimidate a witness. I was a witness in a case, and didn't work, though. You know, being from back east, I've seen bodies in trunks and all of that. But anyway, I think we have too many lawyers, and it's time to rein them in, and that's an important aspect of any proposed national health care program or, quote, reform, is to definitely thoroughly reform the tort lawyers and that whole process. People should be compensated when they are injured because of the incompetence or malpractice of doctors. But the way things have gotten so out of control, and here's something to think about. John Edwards, who knocked up this woman and then lied about it, he made his money in being a tort lawyer and, quote, malpractice. Of course, nobody looks at lawyers' malpractice, and there's a growing amount of that. It's just not publicized by the leftist media for a lot of reasons. But anyway, it's something that people should pay attention to, because these people do make the laws. They do affect everybody's lives, and, the laws they make for everybody else should apply to them, and if they won't apply them to themselves, they should be forced out of a public employ. I've got an evil cat here at my foot. But anyway, it's something that people need to think about. Also, you need to start thinking about who vets judges. People are beginning to look at they in California, they make over $150,000 a year, plus some of them are retiring with huge retirements of a couple hundred thousand dollars a year. These are California state employees. And there's a growing number of these people who defy federal law, defy even basic state law. And it's time that these people either reform themselves, be reined in, or be forced out. And, people should pay more attention as to who vets these people in the first place and how they end up sitting on the bench, because you never know. You may be in front of some of these people, and you wish you knew more about them before they don the black robes. So thank you again for those of you who listened, and do call in the next time. We'll be back Thursday at this hour. This 45 minutes works out. We'll keep the 5 o'clock hour. I don't want to keep it too late. And this is Peter Paul Brizola for The New Shadow. And thank you for listening. And do tune in Thursday. And also go to our YouTube video sites, Amicus Veritas, and go to our websites, amicusveritas.org, and then the blog, and then just follow the links to whatever interests you, which is on that site. This is Peter Paul. This is Peter Paul Verzola signing off. Thank you for listening.